Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. How young is too young to get married? And who gets to decide? That's been up for debate in the New Hampshire legislature this year. The state's current legal marriage age is 13 for girls and 14 for boys, although permission from parents and court approval is required. Now, though, there's general agreement that the age should be older. But what should it be? What exceptions might be allowed? And whose decision is it? That's what we're asking this hour on The Exchange. And later in our show, an update on this year's flu season, so you can get your questions in on that as well. Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We have three guests for this segment of our show. Dan Itza is here, Republican representative from Fremont, vice chairman of the Children and Family Law Committee, and Representative Itza, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Representative Jackie Silley, Democrat from Barrington, sponsor of bills this a bill this session to set the marriage age at 16, along with another bill, which I'm sure we'll hear about. Representative Silley, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Leah Plunkett, Associate Professor of Legal Skills at UNH Law and founder of the Youth Law Project at New Hampshire Legal Assistance. And Leah, welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Leah, just to you first, what's the context for these laws setting marriage ages, some of them pretty young in New Hampshire and other states? When did these come about? What was going on in society when people said, yeah, sure, a 14-year-old could get married?
Well, it goes way, way back, Laura, to the common law tradition that we inherited in this country from England. In the very early common law tradition, I believe children as young as 7, which seems really crazy, I think, to all of us. I have a 7-year-old son at home, and I can't even get him to put his boots where they belong. but then that was a very long time ago phase. The common law that we inherited from England, painting with a broad brush here, when the country was founded, was looking more, I believe, at roughly 12 for girls, 14 for boys. And then because marriage is typically the province of state legislatures to decide, you saw at the time that the country was founded and other states came in that states appropriately reflected their, you know, their own norms around these questions of public health, safety, and welfare. And so a lot of the current iterations of the laws, and again, painting with a very broad brush across the country, go back a little bit to the late 19th, early 20th century, when state legislatures started looking at the role of children in society more broadly with respect not just to marriage, but to education and child labor and other ways in which we either let or don't let people who are below 18 or 21 in some cases participate in society.
Well, it's interesting because I was going to ask you, why do states decide marriage law? Why isn't it up to the federal government? Or on the other end, why isn't it just up to the individual family?
So the federal government has limited enumerated powers, and there are certainly ways, some of which have been very high profile in recent years, where either federal statutes or the federal constitution do require the federal legislature or federal judges, depending on the procedural path, to weigh in on marriage questions. But in general, federal government, limited enumerated powers, state governments, general police powers over safety, health, and welfare, which is why we leave it up to the states. In terms of why it's not completely up to the individual, you know, there's certainly some scholars and other advocates who might say it should be that we're in the 21st century. And actually, if you build on some of the language in recent Supreme Court decisions in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, that marriage is sort of the highest way we express ourselves, it's our destiny, I'm painting with a broad brush again, maybe it should be. But it hasn't been, Laura, because traditionally, marriage has been seen as one of the fundamental ways that we order society. And because society, through its government and also through its religious and other non-governmental institution, confers special benefits and other types of status on married couples, then that is actually a governmental question about when and how it is proper to allow folks to enter into that particular type of contract, different from a contract for my cell phone or my car or whatnot.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about the contractual aspects of this later. But Representative Silley, to you, how do New Hampshire's marriage laws compare to other states?
Well, thank you for the question. And I actually want to come back to Leah's point about contracts as well. New Hampshire's marriage laws are, you know, some of the youngest. They're, as I said, 13 years old, as you noted. And but some states have no lower age limit.
So in some states, and I did a review of this myself yesterday, a lot of states seem to say 18, a lot of states seem to say 16, well, a lot of states seem to say 16, but with exceptions, with permission and so forth, you can go lower.
Exactly. Most of them, I think, except for Mississippi, which is 21, and Nebraska, which is 19, actually set the bar at 18, and then below that, it's exceptions. Mm-hmm. So it's exceptions in New Hampshire down to 13, but with little judicial guidance. But I want to come back to that point that Leah made about, you know, contractual law. I mean, if you look at marriage as your basic social contract from a civil standpoint, it is a contract that two people enter into. And the U.S. General Accounting Office says that contract carries with it about 1,138 individual rights, responsibilities, and obligations. So to think of a 13, 14, 15, even a 16 and 17-year-old to be allowed to take on a contract that has that kind of gravity when they can't buy a car, they can't take out a loan, they can't open a savings or, you know, a savings or checking account at their bank. I mean, if you think of all the things we do not allow minors under the age of 18 to do, it makes no sense.
I'd love to ask you, too, about that, Representative. It's just reflecting on this. There is so much we don't allow people under age 18 to do. So should we allow them to get married?
Well, I would say under special circumstances, and it's interesting when you reflect on it, and the professor brought up an interesting aspect of common law. Under common law, the age of majority was 21. If you look at our statutes, when we dropped the age of majority to 18, it was actually a suspension of that aspect of common law. So historically, you had majority age 21, except if you got married. Once you got married, then you were emancipated because you formed a new household.
What about now, Representative Itza? What do you think? Should, you know, again, there's so much that we don't let 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds do, so should we let them get married? Just wonder what you think.
Again, under special circumstances, there are certain compelling reasons. One would be pregnancy. Another is where you have a spouse going into the service of the military that in turn affords them particular benefits, particularly death benefits. And unless they're married, they can't obtain those death benefits. So there are – and this is somebody that, you know, in a perfect world, if you were, they could form that relationship with. So, yeah, there are compelling reasons, I think, that to have the parental filter and the judicial filter on it is good. I mean, you don't want I don't think you want simply the parental filter, because you can imagine parents agreeing to a marriage for less than genuine reasons. But if you've passed the parental filter, which is kind of the first best interest of the child, and you pass the judicial filter, which says there's nothing strange going on here, and there's a compelling reason, which is what's in Representative Silley's other bill, but rare.
Well, I want to ask about your bill and the judicial review, also Representative Silly. But let me just remind our listeners that we'd love to hear from you. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today in Exchange, how young is too young to get married, and who should decide that? Again, we'd love your thoughts on that question. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So just to clarify, right now, it's not like middle schoolers, Representative Itzik, can just run off and get married. They have to get parental permission and this judicial approval. What are those judges, Representative Silly, looking for when they look at these very young brides or grooms?
Well, because there's really no guidance from the legislature, it's difficult to tell. Now, there was a situation about 5 years ago where a 13-year-old married a 17-year-old in Newmarket, and it was heard before Judge Kelly. In 30 minutes, that couple was granted an exemption to get married. 4 months later, they were divorced. And the judge said in an interview with the union leader that he would welcome some additional guidance from the legislature. He also agreed with Representative Itza in that, you know, he believes that there should be an objective third party, and he feels that's the courts to make this decision. But he'd like to see more, and that there should be some, you know, exceptions.
So he felt like he could have used more guidance in making that decision. He didn't have that guidance, so he felt like he had to go ahead and say okay.
Well, I suppose so.
Yeah.
But I'd like to also address one of the points that Representative Itza made about the military, because this was used last year. Representative Itza and his entire committee passed a bill unanimously to set the bar at 18. That's really what we want.
18, no exceptions.
18. And advocates across this country want 18. I was thrilled they did that with the bill, and it got killed on the floor. And one of the reasons it got killed was because of this issue of military. Well, you can't go in the military unless you're 18 years old. If you're 18 years old and you're with somebody under, once you enter the military for service, I believe it's 18, and the military code of justice says you cannot have relations with somebody under the age of 16. So my hope is this year we should be able to set that bar with no question about, you know, allowing a 13, 14, or 15-year-old to get married under the age of 16, because with our military code of justice, that's considered statutory rape.
Could we talk about that a little bit more? Go ahead, Representative Itzen. I have another question for you, Leah.
You can go into the military at the age of 17 with parental consent. And so that's not an absolute bar. You can also have a relationship that was formed before turning 18, and then the person turns 18 and they're eligible at their own discretion to go into the military. So I don't think it's inappropriate. And I have to tell you, when I voted in favor, there were two aspects. One issue was whether or not it should be the same for both traditional and same-sex couples. The other issue, the other thing was, at the time you're voting, you had this niggling thing in the back of your mind that something that there was a that you were doing something that wasn't quite the right thing to do, but you didn't have any articulation, no hard evidence to say this is a problem. When it was presented on the floor that there was a particular issue that at least we hadn't navigated yet.
You hadn't thought about that aspect.
Hadn't thought about that aspect.
Moment.
In our minds, I know a lot of the committee that had voted yes voted against it on the floor because now they knew what had been in the back of their mind.
You know, Representative Silly mentioned statutory rape, Leah, and pretty powerful word. Just remind us what statutory rape is and how does that fit into these underage marriages?
Sure, Laura. So very powerful phrase, and one that's, very much, I think, on people's minds these days with the Me Too moment we're having and other, other public conversations. So in New Hampshire, the general term statutory rape actually covers a number of different categories. So we say statutory rape when you pull up RSA 632A, you see different categories. You see felonious sexual assault, aggravated felonious sexual assault, and sexual assault. So I'll focus on sexual assault and felonious sexual assault. And so under 632A:3 Roman numeral 2, You commit felonious sexual assault, which is a, I believe, a Class B felony. If you have penetration with a person other than your spouse who is 13 or older but under 16, and the age difference is 4 years or more. Now, go to the sexual assault subchapter. So get rid of the word felonious for a second. We're talking about misdemeanor now. And 632-A:4, if you have non-penetration and sexual contact with somebody between 13 and 16 who's not your spouse, and the age difference is 5 or more years, and then there's another category. There are a bunch of categories, but there's a third category I'll flag because I think it's the last one that's kind of the most relevant to our discussion. Still in the sexual assault category, if you have sexual penetration, not with a spouse, and the age difference is 4 years or less.
So it sounds like there's some exceptions for spouses there.
There are exceptions all over the place for spouses in our sexual assault statutes, correct?
Go ahead, Representative
Sillie. That's actually the other bill that I that I'm prime sponsoring this term, is to say that a judge cannot confer marital status on a couple for whom, in a situation in which the act would otherwise be a rape. So if Representative Itz's committee passes this bill, it will say a judge cannot confer marriage on a, 21-year-old and a 15-year-old, even if they have not entered into a sexual relationship prior to the marriage, because by conferring marriage, you're sanctifying something that would otherwise, under our laws, be illegal.
That's the judicial bill that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and I'd like to put a personal face on this as well. This is an extreme example, but it's not the only example in this country. And this is what worries me, and it worries the advocates that keep pushing to increase the age of marriage. You may have noticed in the headlines recently that there was a couple that had abused. They have 13 children, and the stories
of abuse.
Terrible
story in California.
It was awful. These kids were shackled to beds. They were starved. Well, it turns out that the husband of that couple, who's 8 years older than his wife, originally abducted her when she was 16 and took her to Texas. The parents brought him back, but then the father of the girl turned her back over to him and allowed him to marry her.
Let's go to our listeners and see what they think. And I have a lot more questions for all of you about the bills and so forth and what may happen going forward. But bringing our listeners in, let's go to Peggy in Center Harbor. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Peggy, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I just think that the legislators, whoever's making these rules, needs to look at the recent studies that have been done on the teenage brain and what has been found out, or I read books about this, that the frontal lobe of the brain does not actually mature until 21 years old or older. And teenagers are very subject to making poor decisions because of that. I think we have to look at that.
Peggy, thank you for the call. And Representative Itz, we've talked a ton about this on the show, that more and more we realize those teenage brains aren't working as adult-like as we previously thought. What do you think about incorporating that latest research into our legislation?
Well, I think, in a sense, we do, and we're proposing to. Again, you're not allowing the minors to simply run off and get married. So you're putting the filter on of two independent parties that are hopefully well over the age of 25. You know that as much as anybody can be anticipated to be mature, they would be. I mean, I would hope that a judge who's looking at this is not only looking at, the legal age difference and things like that, but are the two families supportive of the relationship. Something like that has a much higher probability of success than if one of them is just trying to get rid of a daughter or get rid of a son
or the teenager,
or they're just walking
the
away,
house.
or they've been divorced multiple times. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the gray to consider.
Sure. And coming up, we'll try to clarify what the key bills are in the legislature, including, seems to be consensus around a bill making the age 16, but whether there should be exceptions or not. We'll talk about that. Peggy, thank you so much for the call. We'll hear from you as well in just a moment. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how young is too young to get married? We're looking at the cultural, political, and legal issues involved in this question as New Hampshire lawmakers look at raising the current age of 13 for girls and 14 for boys. Again, marriage would be allowed only, or is allowed only, with parental and judicial consideration. But still, there is a movement in the legislature to raise the age. We're looking at that. Send us an email. Tell us what you think. exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, as I said, there are a couple bills in the legislature with different aspects of attached to this issue, and we've touched on them, but just to clarify, Leah Plunkett, what's the main point of some of these key bills? My understanding is consensus around the issue of 16, but some differences.
That's right, Laura. And the ones that I understand to be sort of the key contenders, and I would certainly invite my fellow guests who are front and center on this to correct me if I'm wrong or overlooking anything, I have before me House Bill 1287, 1587, and 1586. House Bill 1287 would raise the age for both boys and girls, males and females, to 16, with an exception for pregnancy, or if one of the individuals is a member of the U.S. Armed Forces, in which case the minimum age for females shall be 13, minimum age for males shall be 14. So that would actually preserve that gender-based difference that's currently
in
those two limited instances. Categories. That's right, Laura. 1587 would be a change for boys and girls to 16. Interestingly, the language in 1587 preserves the age of 18 for same-sex couples.
I saw that when I was going through the literature yesterday.
So there's still that different. And then, again, and I'm sorry, I should also add, Representative Silley, that attached to 1587 would be a whole new chapter, 546C, on emancipation.
I've asked them to remove
that. Because
there's another standalone bill.
Okay, understood.
And that has complications.
Thank you for the clarification. So. Last but certainly not least, 1586, I believe this is the one we were discussing right before the break, would add language saying that a justice or judge cannot grant permission to marry if sexual contact or sexual penetration between the parties would, but for the marriage, constitute sexual assault, felonious sexual assault, or aggravated felonious sexual assault under RSA 632A, which is that scheme of sexual assault laws I talked about before. My reading of that is under that bill, Representative Silley gave us an example of the kinds of circumstances this bill, if passed and signed into law, would prohibit. It also looks to me like it would prohibit a scenario of, let's say, a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old if they were going to have sex with penetration, because under the sexual assault chapter, we have, without the spousal exception, a misdemeanor-level offense of sexual penetration between 13 and 16 if the age difference is 4 years or less. So actually, it would also be a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old even under this scheme could not get married if they plan to have that as part of their marriage.
So it sounds like, Leah, two bills both saying, age 16, but one has exceptions and one doesn't.
And two bills, both, that's correct, and then with this additional way of in the bill I just was talking
about. Sure, clarifying for judges.
Exactly.
But in terms of the age itself, Representative Itza, which of these approaches do you think is better? No marriages at all under 16, or marriages under 16 with these exceptions?
I've really been pondering that the last couple of days, and part of me doesn't really want to say never, 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 because I don't know that there isn't somewhere that one place where it makes sense. On the other hand, I have a hard time imagining the place where it does make sense. You would have to have – you'd have to be traveling downhill with a following wind. I mean, you'd have to have real familial support of the couple for instance. I mean, and again, that's really where having the dual approval process is important.
The parental and the judicial.
We will debate it.
Sounds like you're a little unsure still. You're still pondering.
I want to hear everybody weigh in. I mean, that's what we do in committee.
Sure.
All these bills are going to go to one subcommittee, and we're going to hash it all out. I mean, just listening to the statutes, and I haven't really looked at the sexual assault statutes recently, but I'm not sure under what metrics you could even get down to 13 and 14.
I'm not sure you could. That's kind of where I was going with that discussion.
And there is broad support in the committee for the judicial instruction bill.
Making it clear for judges who would weigh in on these.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Representative Cilley. I can see you want to jump into.
Well, that's and I think you're referring to HB 1661, right? That Representative Amanda Gorg was the prime sponsor of another very important bill in this mix, and that's the one that would provide the guidance for judges and, you know, to have judges do an assessment as to the maturity of the couple. And also, you know, that there's no duress and so on. So that bill lays out a number of criteria that I think addresses some of Judge Kelly's concerns. I also want to pick up on the fact, you know, according to statistics that were actually put together by Frontline NPR and the Tahiri Justice Center, Unchained at Last, these are organizations that are fighting to raise the age to 18. What we find is that more than three quarters, about 86% of the minors that are getting married are young girls, and they're marrying older boys. So, and sometimes men. 40% of the marriages to minor girls are older men over the age of 21.
And we have that data because when you get married, it's a contract, and those things are written down.
That's right. And I'll come back to my original point. If marriage is the, you know, sort of the most sanctified social contract two people can enter into, then shouldn't that be the same as any other type of contractual relationship?
So,
and we don't even know. We know the divorce rate is higher, the poverty rate's higher, the lack of education's higher by young people who get married. We don't even know. And Leah, maybe you can address this. It is unclear as to what a 15-year-old or 16-year-old's legal status is to fight for her kids, to, you know, to be able to take out a lease for an apartment and so on. So when the marriage dissolves, as it did in the case in Newmarket, where's that girl left?
I can see you want to jump in, Representative Itza, and then I got a couple of listener comments as well.
I just wanted to chime in. One, I recently got my ham radio license and was talking on the radio with somebody who had a sister that got married, I don't remember what age, but under the age of 18. And she's had a very successful 30-year marriage. She's living out in Wyoming somewhere or someplace like that. But, you know, it's a success story.
We can't say in every single instance this is going to be a disaster.
On the other hand, the idea of ensuring that we're not allowing the union of an older male or older female, for that matter, with a younger individual, I think is very prudent. I mean, on the flip side, we say the age for consent is 16. The natural result of consent is a child. The best place to raise a child is in an intact family. So that's the balance.
You know, it's interesting, and you talked earlier, Representative Itza, about your struggle with trying to figure out the right bill to vote for. What's the ideal in your mind, Representative Cilley, in terms of legislation from the state of New Hampshire?
I'm going to continue to fight for 18.
18 and exceptions?
No exceptions.
None. Military, pregnancy, nothing.
No, because I think that gives uniformity and consistency to our laws.
And because at 18, you're considered a legal adult.
That's correct.
Okay, so Representative Itza talked about other situations, and other people feel this way, especially with pregnancy, that a child should not be raised out of wedlock, so to speak. That's a deeply held belief for some folks. So how do you square your feelings with those deeply held
values?
Well,
first of all, what's the difference between a 12-year-old pregnant girl, an 11-year-old pregnant girl, 10-year-old? I mean, because these are cases across the country, right? And So there's nothing that prevents a couple from raising their child, from being listed as parents on that child's birth certificate, from co-parenting. The only thing we're saying is that we would not allow a contractual relationship conferring 1,138 rights, responsibilities, and obligations at an age where you can't buy a car.
Do you want to jump in, Leah, on just how lawmakers are sort of wading through this and some of the things that keep coming up? You know, what it means to be a legal adult, what statutory rape means, entering into a contract. You can't do that when you're 15. I'd love to hear from you, and then I can see you want to jump into, Representative Itza.
Sure. So lawmakers are tasked with a really tough set of questions here, Laura.
I'm getting that impression,
right?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of what we think of as kind of fundamental rights and liberties at play here. And if you look at the United States Supreme Court, the New Hampshire Supreme Court, you will see a lot of very powerful language that is also binding law around an individual's right to self-determination and autonomy around these most intimate questions of our lives. You know, do we bear and beget a child? Do we raise that child with this partner or that partner? And in one of the most high-profile decisions around this set of topics recently, the same-sex marriage case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Obergefell in 2014, the court was very clear, and I'm paraphrasing now, but it said marriage shapes destiny. And so what lawmakers are tasked with doing is really nothing less, Laura, than thinking about what are constitutional, legal, and really ethical and practical ways to say this is the set of circumstances under which we will let minors, and Representative Silley's right, you know, minors lack capacity in almost all other ways under the law. Not every way, but almost all other ways. But how do we thread the needle so that they are able, with appropriate parental and judicial intervention, if that's what the legislature says, to shape their destinies, but not just in the immediate or short-term, Laura, also for the rest of their lives.
So as adults, we're looking, you know, way out for young people.
Correct.
Even though they only see what's right in front of them. And I'm speaking as the mother of two teenagers. So go ahead, Representative Itza.
And actually, I have a question for Leah, because I was kind of struck when I saw some of the background regarding emancipation, and our emancipation law is actually an overturn, if you will, of common law. And I had always understood that marriage equaled emancipation. And I was wondering if that was a common law situation, that marriage equaled full emancipation. And if so, what does that do to the ability to enter into other contracts? Because I would think that in fact authorizes other contracts, and I'm not sure.
That's really interesting and a good question. So usually the age of majority, you're considered an adult, is 18. But if marriage is emancipation and you enter into it at 17, are you then considered an adult? It's a great question.
I don't believe that we have sort of one-stop shopping that way in New Hampshire at this point. We don't we have emancipation as a process you can go through with the court. We don't have, and correct me if I'm mistaken, but I do not believe that we currently have a statute that draws that kind of bright line. If you are married, you are then emancipated and can do all these other things that an adult would do.
And that's why I was asking the professor regarding common law. What is the common law which would prevail if there were no statute?
So that would be essentially what we have now, which is that our courts, and we have wonderful courts here with wonderful ability to interpret our common law, would be applying common law precedent on a case-by-case basis to situations that came before them.
Well, a bunch of emails that I'd love to share with you. And this is from Rachel. I don't understand why there needs to be any exceptions for the age limit. I cannot conceive of any scenario where it is appropriate for a 13-year-old child to get married. Robert in Epsom says, in theory, we hope for all marriages to start and stay happy. But since terminating a marriage is less controversial than terminating a pregnancy, whatever age is set without parental consent should apply to both. It should be obvious that an unwanted pregnancy is not the foundation for a happy marriage. So that's from Robert. And then here's a person who didn't want to give his or her name. A child going into marriage at too young an age can be seen as giving up her freedom to determine her own future. In this live free or die state, this person says, shouldn't we be moving to protect our youth in ways that will allow them to develop into fully functioning adult members of society? It is my guess that in too many cases, even parents in these cases no doubt often regret their decisions. And again, I want to thank everybody for the emails. And Representative Silley, thoughts there from our listeners. I wonder what you think.
Well, what I can tell you is what happened after last year when this bill got killed on the House floor. This was the 18. One of the things that upset me about that is the fact that they used a mechanism called indefinite postponement where they killed the ability to even discuss the age of 18, you know, for the biennium. So I couldn't bring a bill in that, you know, that tried to do this again. What we discovered after that bill was killed is there was not just rage within the state. This went around the globe. The young woman on whose behalf I filed the original bill, a Girl Scout from Barrington, Cassie Levesque, has been interviewed by the BBC, by Samantha Bee's Full Frontal, by the New York Times magazine. The interviews have gone around the world.
It's not the first time the New Hampshire legislature has made international news,
no,
by
that
the
is
way.
True. That is true. But what we found is I was invited to speak to several women's groups prior to the legislation being heard, and they showed up and they signed in. I think we saw a lot more participation this year. Because frankly, when I brought the first bill, I thought this would be like a blue law and it would be easy to fix.
A blue law is a law dating way back from...
Right. So I thought, well, we really don't allow 13-year-olds to get married in the state of New Hampshire. And I was a little surprised to discover that within 5 years we actually had. The numbers are not huge, but every one of those numbers represents not only an individual who has a lower chance of success on many dimensions in life, it's also generational. It redounds to that person's children.
Go ahead, Leah.
Just on the numbers, Representative Silley, the New Hampshire Women's Foundation does a great series called Gender Matters, where it gives us numbers mm-hmm. and other data for the state of New Hampshire. And I have in front of me that at least 189 children under the age of 18 have been married in New Hampshire in the last 16 years. So that's enough to fill a couple classrooms at the schools down the street.
Well,
families.
And I have to wrap you guys up. But last question, Representative Itzen, Representative Silley, do I understand that you guys at least agree on the idea that 16 should be the bar? Representative Itza? Sounds reasonable?
It sounds reasonable. I'm going to be sure before I vote, but I think it's a very good point to sit at. It is certainly it's the floor for consensual sex. I mean, if we're not going to allow marriage under the age of 18, why are we allowing sexual activity under the age of 18?
What do you think, Representative Silley?
Well, I'd like to get Representative Itza, who sits on that committee and is vice chair of the committee, to agree that 16 is the absolute red line in the sand, and then we'll work together.
All right. Well, work together has a good ring to it. I want to thank everybody.
I like his thoughtfulness, and I appreciate it.
For coming in, and we'll see what happens on this bill. We'll keep
thank
track.
You.
Representative Silley, it was good to see you. Thank you.
Nice
thank
to
you.
See you.
That's Jackie Silley. She's a Democratic state rep from Barrington. Representative Itza, thank you also for taking time
My
out.
My honor.
That's Dan Itza. He's a Republican from Fremont, vice chair of the Children and Family Law Committee. And Leah Plunkett, always good to have you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Leah Plunkett is an associate professor of legal skills at UNH Law, founder of the Youth Law Project at New Hampshire Legal Assistance. Now, coming up, we're going to switch gears and look at what has been a bad flu season so far in the rest of the country and in New Hampshire. We'll get your questions on the flu this year and advice from a doctor on how best to cope. So send us your questions on that. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Your comments and questions on the flu season coming up, so stay with us.
My name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, New Hampshire's child protection system and new leadership at the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. Now, that's tomorrow on The Exchange. Right now, we're turning our attention to the flu and why many say this is a particularly bad season. Send us your comments, questions, or personal experiences with this year's flu to exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out with this topic is Dr. Pamela Hoffley. She's medical director at Dartmouth Hitchcock Manchester Bedford and a pediatric gastroenterologist. And Dr. Hoffley, I know you're super busy this season. We really appreciate you taking time out. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So we hear that it's bad, and then we hear maybe it's not so bad in certain parts of the country. What does the flu season look like, Dr. Hoffley, from your own perspective in your own office?
So I would say every year flu is a big problem, and there's really no such thing as a mild season. And this year, one of the reasons people are getting worried is really because of the strain that we're seeing. The circulating virus is the H3N2, a virus that compared to H1N1, which we've had in the past, is a little more severe and less responsive to the vaccine, and that's where people are getting worried about it. Right now in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire flu activity level is certainly widespread in the state, but still we're considered low-level activity throughout the country, although we're just starting to see an uptick.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because I've read that it's much worse in other places, that the New England has been obviously not spared, but it hasn't been as bad.
Really hasn't been as bad.
Does that mean we're about to get our turn, or does that mean we're just going to be lucky?
Well, wait and see.
Yeah.
Right now, we're running about 1.4% of visits to doctors right now are for the flu. The national baseline rate is about 2.2%. In other areas of the country, it's like 6.3%.
So flu is responsible for 6% of office visits, which is a lot?
Which is a lot. That's what we're seeing nationally. Here, we're down at 1.4%. But from what I'm hearing from our urgent care and our pediatricians and our primary care physicians, we're starting to see people
I was hoping you'd give me another answer, but I appreciate your honesty.
It might just be that we're just starting to head into our peak now. The good thing about that is it may not be too late to get your vaccine.
Well, and we should talk about the vaccine, but before we do, according to the CDC, a mild year, quote unquote, kills 12,000 Americans. In a bad year, the flu can kill up to 56,000. I was struck by those, Dr. Hoffley. Do you think most people realize how powerful the flu is?
I think we underestimate it. I really do. And I think the public underestimates, and sometimes I think even the physicians and the providers treating patients underestimate it. And I think we have to recognize in high-risk patients, those high-risk populations, that you really are at risk for serious complications like pneumonia and even death. And so if you are one of those high-risk patients, if you are over 65, if you have a child under 2, if you're pregnant, if you have a chronic disease, and you think you're getting the flu, you need to contact your health care provider because there are things we can do to lessen the impact of the flu. There are powerful antiviral medications, but if we wait too long, they don't work as well.
So walk us through that a little bit more because, you know, a lot of people have colds this time of year or sinus infections or bronchial infections. So how do we know when to call the doc? And just as important, how do we know, you know, stay in bed, don't move, and don't come into the office and infect everybody else, you know?
So you may have the flu if you have a fever, although not everyone has a fever, cough, sore throat, runny nose, body aches, headaches, chills, fatigue, which sounds like, as you said, common respiratory illness. But in this season, a lot more of it is the flu. And if you are in those high-risk categories or you're getting really sick, you know, you're having trouble breathing, you're having trouble staying hydrated, you need to call your physician. And there is treatment available.
What is that treatment?
So we have antiviral drugs available that are very effective against the flu if they're given in the first 48 hours that you get symptoms. And that's why we're encouraging people, call us if you're in a high-risk group. This morning, I was meeting with one of our obstetricians at Dartmouth Hitchcock, and she got two calls overnight last night from pregnant women who thought they had flu symptoms. And we're glad they called us overnight because we can get them on antiviral medications and prevent the complications. So don't hesitate to reach out to your provider, especially if you're a high-risk patient, because getting treatment in the first 48 hours really can be effective at shortening the length of the illness, but also lessening the severity. You're still going to be sick, but you're not going to land in the hospital.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it, Dr. Hoffley? Because, you know, you get the symptoms and sometimes you don't know for a while. You think, ooh, it's just a cold, and then you feel worse. And so it's hard to make that assessment quickly enough so that these antiviral drugs have the time to kick in properly.
It can be tricky, but I think if you're in a high-risk group and you've been exposed to someone with the flu, if you think you've got it, you're better safe and give us a call than waiting.
Okay, well, here's an email from someone that came in, and I want to remind everybody, you can email us your questions, comments, and if you have unfortunate personal experiences with this year's flu season, let's hear from you. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So this person emailed us, Janet. She says, I understand that the flu shot this year is only 30% effective, but did I hear that even if you get a different strain that the 30% does not cover, it will help lessen the symptoms? Or would that just be for the 30% that it covers? I thought that I heard that it would help regardless. Important since I bullied my spouse, Janet says, into getting the shot. LOL. Janet, thank you so much. And boy, there's a lot of questions around the shot. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this year's shot.
Yeah. So the shot is about 30% effective against the H3N2 that we are seeing. But the good news is that when we say effective, that means in preventing you getting it altogether. But if you do get the shot, it can lessen the how ill you get. And that's important to know. So it really does. So even when shots fail to stop infection, they do prevent the worst complications. The one thing that we are seeing is that the H3N2 virus that we're seeing right now is the same one that was around last winter in this country. So anyone who caught it last year should be much more immune this year. And if you get a vaccine on top of it, you know, it's going to help.
So even though we only hear it's 30% effective against this H3N2, it might help you even if you do get the flu. Janet also asks, though, what about other strains of the flu? Does the vaccine help against those strains as well?
The vaccine does help against those strains as well. You know, the vaccine primes your body to fight off the flu. And what we're saying is the vaccine this year is not perfect. And I don't think any year we've had a perfect vaccine. We hope some year that we will have that one where you get it once and you don't have to have it for 5 or 10 years. That would be great. The technologies are out
there.
That
would be great.
Technologies are out there. We're hoping the manufacturers can come up with that for us someday. But right now, this is the best we have to offer, and it is certainly better than nothing.
It is frustrating, this process, and I'm sure it is for the scientists and physicians involved that, you know, we've got vaccines for smallpox and polio and, you know, shingles and all these other terrible things. Why can't we get it right with the flu?
The flu virus itself is a tricky virus, and it's been hard because it's a bunch of different viruses. It's not just one. Smallpox is, you know, one thing. This is a whole bunch of different viruses, and they're difficult to, the vaccines are difficult to manufacture.
So a bunch of different viruses, and my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, please, Dr. Hoffley, is each year the vaccine goes after 2 or 3 different strains, but maybe there's 10 strains in a year? Is that?
There's usually 3 or 4 predominant strains in a year, and we try to best guess what those will be in manufacturing the vaccine, but we're not always perfect. I think we knew that this was what the strain was going to be, but this is a difficult one to produce an effective vaccine against. That's the difficulty here.
I'm always amazed that there isn't better science around this, given
there's a lot of people working on it.
Yeah,
a lot of science. I read through some of it, and a lot of stuff I don't completely understand, but a lot of people working on this.
Again, the number for you to join us with your comments, concerns about this year's flu season, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's someone who didn't give a name who says, I think that one of the worst practices that spreads the flu is sick cashiers in grocery stores. We must buy food. I am constantly shocked by the number of cashiers who come to work when they're sick. We stand a couple of feet from them, and they handle every food item that we take home. We have to take change from their hands. This person says there should be a state law prohibiting sick cashiers from coming to work and requiring cashiers to use hand sanitizer regularly. I remember a couple years ago, I went to the grocery store and there was a sick cashier and I thought, oh, this person touched all my food. So what do you think about that, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, I mean, that fits with, you know, simple steps to avoid the spread of germs. While you're sick, you're supposed to stay home and limit contact with others as much as possible. If you're sick with a flu-like illness, stay home for about 24 hours after your flu is, your fever is gone. But some of these people that we're seeing, you know, their flu is over. They stayed home for 3 or 4 days. They've got the remnants of the cough, cold, and are no longer necessarily infectious.
Oh, I
see. And do need to get back to work. But they should be, you know, covering their, if you have a cough, they should be wearing a mask and covering up so that they're not spreading it. And it's, we can do our bit by protecting ourselves. Take your hand sanitizer with you. Use it.
Is hand sanitizer effective?
Hand sanitizer is effective. Yes, it will kill the virus. So my daughter has it in her purse and she uses it all the time before and after, especially at places like you said, at the grocery store.
Here's an email from Wendy who says, my daughter had to come home from Keene State due to the flu. It came on very quickly and the doctor said that it's a good sign that it's not just a cold. She was fine last Thursday and felt awful on Friday. We've gotten Tamiflu, but she's still quite sick. We believe she picked it up on the airplane coming home from a trip to Florida at the end of winter break. If people feel sick very quickly, get to urgent care. Wow. So thank you for that personal story, Wendy. It sounds like it came on very quickly.
Well, the flu can come on very quickly, that sort of overall body aches, fever, and things like that. That's one of those clues that this may be the flu. And it sounds like she did the right thing. She got to the doctor. She got herself on the Tamiflu. And the Tamiflu just decreases the length of time you have it. It's not like it cures it by tomorrow.
Sure.
You're still going to be sick. And then she did the right thing. She came home, limited her exposure to the other kids at school.
Well, and the Tamiflu, we've been all told for years now, don't overuse antibacterial soaps and antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
What about antivirals? Is there a risk of using them when maybe you don't have the flu or overusing them?
I don't think that there's a risk at this point with that. I mean, if people have been exposed, if you're a high-risk population, you've been exposed to the flu, if you're very sick, you're better to take this medication. We're not seeing any resistance develop. There is it's about 98% effective, I think we're at right now, for the H3N2 to these antiviral medications. So we're not seeing resistance. And I don't want to see people hesitate, especially if you're a pregnant lady who's got flu-like symptoms. We'd rather get you on this medication than not.
Wow. Well,
it's
Wendy,
not like waiting a day or two when you have an ear infection.
Good luck to your daughter, Wendy. Thank you for the email. Here's an email from John who says, I work at a wastewater treatment plant. I'm a very healthy person, but every 10 years, John says, I run into this H3N2 version and it just knocks me out. Mm-hmm. John says, why don't I build antibodies? If I do, how long do they last? John, good question.
Well, I think you do build antibodies to the H3N2, and that's why I was saying this year you may be a little better off than you were last year. But the ones that we're seeing may not be identical to the one you saw 10 years ago.
Oh, frustrating. So,
yeah. And that's why it's difficult for us to produce the vaccines. These viruses are just a little different every season, and the vaccine isn't covering them as well. That's why the 30% effectiveness.
Now, in the fall, that's when the flu shot message goes out. Is it worth getting the flu shot now? I mean, here we are, it's almost the end of January.
Well, the flu season is, you know, we haven't peaked yet here in New Hampshire. And even once we peak, we've got weeks of flu left. And the flu season lasts through April. So really getting your shot right now can still protect you through the end of April. It does take 2 weeks for it to work. But if you got it now, then you're protected from, you know, February, March, April. So that's could be a good thing.
Why is there a flu season? Does the virus just die out after a certain time, or
the virus sort of runs its course through the community, and then new waves come in the next year? And it is in the winter that it happens. Cold weather, you know, we don't like the cold weather too much, and we think, you know, we should be safer in the cold weather. But it actually creates ideal conditions for the flu virus, which actually lives longer and replicates faster in cold weather. So the protective layer around the virus is stronger, actually.
Huh, that's
interesting.
In
the cold, and it makes it live longer and replicate more quickly. So we see these cycles through the winter.
Is it because everybody's crowded together in buildings? Is
no,
that
no,
part
the,
of it?
The actual virus survives longer in the cold. So as we get into the hot summer months, it's gone. And then as things get colder again, viruses replicate more quickly. So two things happen in the winter. Virus replicates more quickly and it's more virulent. And yes, we are together and we're shaking hands and spending time together. And so we spread it around as well.
Well, here's another email from Jonathan, who has two questions. Jonathan in Nashua, he says, people that work service industry jobs cannot afford to take time off when they're sick because employers like that don't offer sick days. Jonathan, thank you for the point. And I'm sure in some cases that is true. So those cashiers that our other emailer mentioned may not be able to afford to take time to stay home. Jonathan says, I'm a nurse, and I was wondering if you could talk about Guillain-Barré syndrome and the risk of getting it from the flu shot. Jonathan, thank you for the email.
So there is a suggestion that there can be side effects with the flu shot, although they're few and far between. Guillain-Barré is a neurological condition that can come on after the flu shot. The risk is very low of getting that, and the risk of getting the flu being much higher.
Who should not get the flu shot?
So people who have had Guillain-Barré in the past or a neurological disease similar to that would be exempt from getting the flu shot. Or someone who's had an allergic reaction to the flu shot in the past would not get the flu shot.
Or someone with a compromised immune system?
No, people with compromised immune systems are those high-risk individuals.
They're the prime candidates
for it. They should get the flu shot. And in fact, for individuals over 65, we have a stronger flu shot for them to try and boost their immunity.
What about people who have an egg allergy? Because from what I understand, these vaccines are created somehow in conjunction with eggs.
Yeah. The risk of people getting the flu shot if they have an egg allergy is really very low. And that's something that you would discuss with your physician. Depends on what your, quote, egg allergy is. But all of these questions, you know, when you go to get your flu shot, you talk with your physician about your underlying health state, about your allergies, and then they can make the decisions around whether or not it's appropriate for you to get the flu shot. Or if you don't get it because you've had a Guillain-Barré or something in the past, then you would be eligible for rapid treatment with antivirals if you were exposed to the flu or you got flu symptoms.
That's interesting. Thank you for clarifying that, because that is a concern that I've heard expressed. Last message that you want to send out to Granite Staters today, Dr. Hoffley, about, you know, here we are in the middle of flu season and it could get worse.
Well, I think the message is it's not too late to get your vaccine. It does work. And if you are a high-risk patient or if you get really sick, please don't hesitate to reach out to your healthcare provider and get treated with antivirals, which can be effective and keep you safe.
Dr. Hoffley, I know this is a busy time for you. I really, really appreciate you coming in. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Pamela Hoffley, medical director at Dartmouth Hitchcock, Manchester Bedford, and a pediatric gastroenterologist. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.